From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Seymour Hersh came out with his stunning report in The New Yorker last May about torture at Abu Ghraib prison, the story wasn't over. Whatever the official investigations found, Hersh's sources told him responsibility went to the top levels of the U.S. government. In his new book, Chain of Command, Seymour Hersh connects the dots, making the case that the abuses at Abu Ghraib were no accident. Tonight on Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh on 9/11, Abu Ghraib, and the Bush administration, Chain of Command. But first tonight, we go to Iraq, where scores have been killed in the past 2 days in violence across the country, including at least 59 people today in a massive car bombing on a crowded Baghdad street. Thanasi Kambanis is a reporter for the Boston Globe who's been covering the war in Iraq since the U.S. invasion. I asked him who is driving this surge in intensity at this point, the insurgents or the U.S.?
Well, I think it's certainly the insurgents that are setting the agenda here in Iraq. The very fact that the U.S. and the Iraqi government had to declare an offensive this weekend to retake 4 major areas of Iraq that are in the hands of insurgents shows you how much further the insurgents have come since last June when the United States and its Iraqi allies declared them on the run. The insurgents are not only in control of the streets of Fallujah, but crucial towns south of Baghdad, including Mahmoudiya and Latakia, where all the traffic flows from Baghdad to the south, Bakuba in the north, Samarra in the north, and Tal Afar. That, combined with the attacks we've seen this week in Baghdad, show you that the insurgents are certainly taking the initiative now and have a fearsome amount of strength and resources.
And now this large attack today making what is beginning to shape up as perhaps the most violent week in Baghdad since the spring, since April.
What's been different about these is, first of all, that they're targeting a part of the city that seems to be quickly turning into a miniature Fallujah. And secondly, that in both incidents, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group, Saladin Intad, took credit for the attacks. That's very different and has a different flavor than past suicide bombings, which no one would take credit for. They would kill 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 people and sort of pass into the wave of violence that had taken place. This seems to be part of the concerted campaign. And the assault on Haifa Street on Sunday, as well as today's attacks, had much more the feel of a coordinated military assault. Today's police station, mortared at dawn, according to the police who were there, was cased out by the terrorists who eventually sent a suicide bomb in just as hundreds of police cadets were lining up at an outdoor cafe to fill in their application form. This is a sophisticated operation. This isn't simply one nervous guy behind the wheel of a car packed with explosives looking for a soft target.
And then on the same day, tough reports all over the place. We read that power's been out all over Iraq after pipelines across the Tigris were attacked and set off a kind of chain reaction in power stations, taking them down. Almost a dozen Iraqi police recruits shot to death in Bakuba, fighting in Ramadi. Everywhere you turn, Thanasi.
Yeah, and for the people here, what I was hearing today was increased animosity against the attackers. And I know we've discussed this before, but today it was more vivid to me than in past encounters. And the area around this police station, I mean, there was a horrible scene of carnage. There were puddles of blood everywhere. People were neighbors and shopkeepers were picking the parts of their friends off of roofs and out of trees. And usually the first reaction you hear is an American missile did this, and in a sort of irrational desire to somehow directly blame the Americans for the attack. Today, lots of people were volunteering unasked. The people who did this today were terrorists. They couldn't be resistance fighters. No true Mujahideen would attack and kill civilians like this. Perhaps it's premature to make a call about public opinion, but it seems to me, more so than ever before, people will be quick to condemn the folks behind this attack. So what we could be saying is, at the same time as the attackers are growing bolder and sophisticated, that the public is going to start turning against them as they view them less as freedom fighters and more as terrorists who are preventing any return to normalcy for the people of Iraq.
If Iraqi civilians turn against the perpetrators of these attacks as terrorists, as criminals, what might be the outcome of that, Tanasi? Does it take away support that the terrorists need to operate, or do they go on attacking anyway?
Well, the one beneficiary of that would be the interim Iraqi government, which needs all the support it can get, and as it fails to control security, it's losing a lot of public support. Now, as far as these insurgents, from the indications we've had, it seems like they're getting more and more effective. So, you know, we have the Iraqis and the American forces here claiming that they're getting better intelligence than ever before, more actionable intelligence to strike at insurgents. On Sunday morning, the Iraqis arrested 16 suspected bosses of criminal gangs and terrorist organizations. The U.S. has been bombing in Fallujah and has claimed success in those strikes. At the same time as all this maneuvering, we see the number of attacks rising and the success rate of the insurgents rising. So that tells me that even if the public turns against the insurgents and become more willing to inform on people who plant roadside bombs or people who are building car bombs in their garage, that doesn't necessarily add up to a strategic victory over the insurgents. They seem to be doing quite well regardless of the military force mass against them and regardless of the vagaries of public support for what they're doing.
So for the time being, violence ratcheting up on both sides and one hellacious day in Iraq and Baghdad in particular. Tanasi Kambanis, thanks for being with us.
Take care, Tom.
Tanasi Kambanis is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Baghdad. Since the shocking autumn of 2001, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh has been delivering revelation after revelation about the Bush administration's war on terror, early missteps in the hunt for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, abuses at Guantanamo, and Pentagon stovepiping of intelligence. This spring, it was his reporting on prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib that made headlines around the world. In his new book, Chain of Command, Seymour Hersh presents a deep examination of where responsibility lies for that abuse and arrives at the feet of some of the highest officials in the Bush administration. Tonight on Point, Seymour Hersh on 9/11, the war on terror, and the Bush administration chain of command. When you first heard about Abu Ghraib last May, when you first read about it, maybe in Seymour Hersh's reports, where did you imagine the trail of ultimate responsibility would lead? To GIs in the field, to Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld in Washington? Do you accept the trail of responsibility Seymour Hersh presents now? Will those responsible be held accountable? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reporting on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. He wrote a series of articles last spring that broke open the story of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib. His new book is Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Good evening and welcome, Seymour Hersh.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
So here we are all these months after that first reporting that put the terrible, terrible images and with all of their implications out into the public arena. And what is the case that you are now making, Cyrus?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. After I did those stories for The New Yorker, someone from inside the National Security Council, someone who worked for Condoleezza Rice, got in touch with me, and he said, you ought to hear what I'm going to tell you. I want to tell you something. He said that, and he told me about an account that I actually begin the book with. In the fall of 2002, in this late summer, I'd say August perhaps, there was an internal investigation done of the American prison at Guantanamo, Gitmo, we call it. Mm. This was the prison set up after the war began in Afghanistan when we began to develop an awful lot of detainees, we call them unlawful detainees, etc. And eventually we set up this prison. And by the summer of 2002, long before Iraq, there were 600 people there being interrogated, et cetera, bad guys, none of whom the president publicly declared the Geneva Convention didn't apply to them. Although he wasn't going to, he was going to treat them anyway under the Geneva Convention, but they didn't apply. It was his call, basically. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is there's a wonderful person, maybe he's not such a wonderful person, but there's a senior official of the CIA who was born in Palestine. Speaks idiomatic Arabic and was sort of their expert on the Islamic culture. And he saw a lot of the intelligence reports and nothing good was coming. So he took himself off to Guantanamo and he came back and told his colleagues the horrible story. He also wrote a report. But what he told them was this, that A, there were war crimes, in his opinion, being committed there. There were men, he saw some men 80 years and older, that was his guess, who were living in their own cages with their own jails, or other cells with their own in their own excrement, bound up. He talked to perhaps 30 of the detainees. Since his Arabic was so good, he could have good conversations with them. In his estimation, half of them had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or the war against America. And there was no process for differentiating, as is required under the Geneva Convention, those who were guilty of something and those who weren't. Everybody was just there together. As he said to people, if they weren't Al-Qaeda when they got to Guantanamo, they sure will be when and if we release them.
So he came back shocked and upset at what he'd seen, as you reported.
Right.
And how does
right.
that translate into responsibility for Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld?
He wrote a report that eventually got into the hands of a retired Air Force four-star general named John Gordon, who had retired as a deputy director of the CIA and knew this fellow, who I don't name under the rules. He asked me not to name him, and of course I agree. I'm glad somebody like that works for the American government and the CIA. And Gordon's one of these generals that anybody would go into a foxhole with. He just has enormous integrity, and he understood something very basic, which is there are two basic points. One is, you don't treat prisoners any differently than you'd expect our soldiers to be treated if they were captured. And two, you don't get intelligence. Any expert will tell you. You don't get any expert in the American government will tell you. You don't get good intelligence by coercion and by force. You get good intelligence by maintaining rapport with people and getting them convinced in some way that you're the good guys. In any case, Gordon did the unthinkable, as I wrote in the White House, because the Bush White House, like all White Houses, doesn't want to hear bad news. He lobbied for a full-scale National Security Council in discussion of this report. And there was a lot of opposition from the vice president's office. As far as people there were concerned, everybody in Guantanamo deserved to be there, and who cares? The same with the general counsel, Mr. Gonzalez, his office objected. But he found that he rallied enough support that, to her credit, Condoleezza Rice had a meeting. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, comes to the meeting. At a critical moment, the case is outlined, muted, but it's still there.
And this is the fall of 2002 still?
This is about September, October. And she asks Rumsfeld to look at it, look into it. He says, I will. And he goes off and assigns a 31-year-old aide who's never had anything to do with prison policies, an arms control guy, to do it. As those in the White House who pushed for the meeting said to me, or said, you know, those to the White House, the attitude was very clear that among those who wanted a meeting, that they walked away from it. They were exposed to the problems in Guantanamo at the highest levels in the White House, and they chose to do nothing. Nothing came out of this series.
You described the Pentagon as going into full stall, but it doesn't seem a stretch from that to full responsibility for what happened, not in Guantanamo, but Abu Ghraib.
Well, but wait a second,
yep.
Tom. Who's talking about full responsibility? I mean, find me the language where I say
responsibility. Responsibility.
Well, but that's very significant because the difference here's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about the military we know is that they're very sensitive to the chain of command. And if you're a platoon officer or leader of a platoon or a company or a brigade or a division or you're Secretary of Defense or you're the President or the Vice President of National Security Council, if you make it clear from the first time you hear about potential problems that this will not stand, that word goes like a rock from the top to the bottom.
And if you you're saying you actually sort of plant the seed.
Well, you're countenancing it. Mm-hmm. By this time, we'd also known we'd had some problems. There had been stories. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International had been reporting already a lot of problems with. Inevitably, people came into our house and knocked it down. There was a lot of anger, a lot of mistreatment, and even that wasn't dealt with. But let's go on.
Seymour Hersh, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Sure.
We're talking tonight with investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. His new book is Chain of Command. You can join the conversation. Has justice been done in the Abu Ghraib case? Has responsibility landed where it should, anywhere near where it should? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Seymour Hersh, author of the new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. You can join the conversation. Has responsibility for Abu Ghraib landed where it should, anywhere near where it should? And is Seymour Hersh a hero to you or a provocateur? There's a question. And this, should Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice take the rap for American torture at Abu Ghraib? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Seymour Hersh, you've got us then to 2002 and the kind of ground laid, as you describe it, for what came later, a kind of responsibility, but that's not all you're reporting here.
No. One of the critical things that's of most interest to me was at the time of the meeting, both Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice knew something many of the other senior people in the White House did not know because it was so secret. And that was that in the fall, within a few months of 9/11, the Pentagon under Rumsfeld had set up a very secret unit, a commando unit, and that unit was assigned the responsibility. They were all, everybody in it was undercover. My understanding is, and I don't mean this literally, but the Canadian, Jordanian passports, they were using foreign identification in many cases. They had their own independently chartered aircraft. They had their own independently chartered helicopters. They had an ability to go anywhere in the world, and they were authorized to do so, and snatch guys that were determined by us to have some direct information about Al-Qaeda and potential terrorist activities. And to justify the thinking, in all fairness to them, there was a tremendous concern for months after 9/11 that there would be another attack, that we needed to get intelligence immediately. We were very nervous and frightened and also angry. Mm-hmm. And also this unit, people tell me in the beginning it really did do some things. It would go and snatch people. I guess you could call it, even if you want to be, it's not unfair to say they disappeared some people. People were taken from wherever they lived in the Indonesia or in Yemen and suddenly disappeared, were taken to, oh, I can tell you, countries like Egypt and Singapore and Thailand, where they were interrogated, sometimes by local officials, sometimes eventually by Americans. This unit was operating at the time. So Rice and Rumsfeld also knew more than others about what really was going on with the prison system and the system of how we were treating people. What happens, the next step in this that gets very interesting, this group operated. It was known and it was controlled under a Pentagon program that was known as a separate a SAP, a special access
special
program.
Access,
it was yes, it's one of those. I don't even know the code words now. They've changed since I wrote it. Obviously, it still operates. And in any case, so move along.
But special access meaning it's kind of invisible. If you don't know about it, you can't really find out about it.
It's more than that. There are two kinds of special access programs in the Pentagon. One, you know, most of the major weapon systems that were secret, the stealth bomber, the Predator, the unmanned aircraft, were built in SAPs because you could hide them. They're totally separated from the regular, normal vagaries of the bureaucracy. Mm. There's something called an unacknowledged SAP, which this program was. And by the way, there was a finding. The president, legally under the law, the president has to make a determination that this is a national security of interest. It's briefed to certain members of Congress. And all of this, as I write in the book, I've done the work on it. It exists. And this group is operating independently, good, bad, or otherwise. Certainly, I think a lot of people said that in the early days they produced some great stuff. If they found somebody that wasn't useful, he was hide off or shipped off to Guantanamo. The first cut went to this group. In the fall of 2003, where are we? In August of 2000, it's just like I was listening to your news broadcast and to your interview, and reminded me, in the fall of 2003, if you remember, the insurgency was wild then, too, in Iraq. We had the UN embassy, UN compound blown up.
Yep.
We had the Jordanian embassy blown up. We had water pipelines cut, oil pipelines cut. We had explosions in electrical facilities. It was a chaos. And at that time, some members of this unit were brought into the Iraqi prison system because we did not have any intelligence. I would proffer we still do not.
But the Department of Defense was desperate to understand what was going on in Iraq.
And not only that, you're getting into something called election year. This is the fall of 2003, and the next year is an election. An enormous concern in the government, in the White House, about finding out how to get these guys. And one of the things the people in the SAP, one of the ideas that generated, one of the intellectual ideas was this. That the way to break an Arab, chopping off hands, which seems logical, isn't the way. The way to do it is humiliation. and sexual humiliation is a key ingredient.
You're saying no Arab in particular, they had a kind of a cultural theory of the culture here.
Well, I think the Quran says no male can be sewn in the front nude, can be seen in the front nude. And if you go to a sports club in Cairo, and it's so different than an American, you know, where we all shower together. There, everybody has a stall. Privacy is very important. Mm-hmm. The idea is, I think the intellectual idea, to give them their due. The idea was you come and you by this time in the fall of 2003, we've got a huge crop of people in jails. And much less differentiation. Many of them were just picked up in random roadside sweeps or we busted in the house. There's no differentiation. We don't have any intelligence. The idea was get some guys, photograph them, put them in compromising positions, photograph and blackmail them, in other words. Sure. Tell them, we're going to send you home. And if we want you to go home, we want you to join the insurgency, and we want you to tell us what you're finding out, to sort of be double agents.
Or all this will be public and you'll be shamed for life.
You got it. That was the intellectual idea. So people have explained to me. What happened is that it quickly got out of control. It ended up in Abu Ghraib and ended up with the photographs. Those hapless GIs, reservists who are now facing prosecution, certainly are guilty of what they did. Mm. But if anybody wants to believe a bunch of reservists from West Virginia understood that the way to humiliate an Arab man was to strip him, photograph him doing simulated acts, have a girl with her thumbs up or down, well, you know, I'll sell you a bridge. And so that was the end. And I'll tell you just one more thing before we move on. Within a month or two of this stuff getting out of control in the fall of 2003, the CIA, which had people assigned into the prison system, and they're not, you know, wallflowers when it comes to being very tough in interrogation, some of our paramilitary people. Nonetheless, they were ordered out of Abu Ghraib by the senior officials in the agency back in Washington. Mm. There was an understanding that this was so crazy, it could only rebound badly and hurt everybody. So they pulled their people out. And this was late October, maybe early November. And they pulled them out after getting legal opinions that what was going on was unconscionable. And so how much, who knew what, where? I write in this book that there were some military guys who informed the senior commanders, most specifically General Abizaid, the commander of the Central Command, the four-star general, and his deputy. But, of course, I can't name these people. It's the old anonymous business that's always, you know, I've been writing stories based on anonymous sources for 40 years. And all I can tell you is that people in the system who would speak out publicly, as some people have said they should have, would be their careers would be over. This is not going to happen.
Cyrus, we'll talk about that, but I want to just establish so we fully understand the kind of lines of responsibility you're drawing, you're suggesting here. Is there an additional line in the fall of 2003 that you're taking all the way up to Rice and Rumsfeld again, or is this more diffuse?
Well, they certainly, the decision to take the special team with their insight about sexuality and the potential of blackmail, I can't tell you that Donald Rumsfeld or Condoleezza Rice knew those details. I can tell you that the military people running the team, the intelligence people running this commando unit, fought this tooth and nail. And Rumsfeld and his deputy for intelligence, an official named Stephen Cambone, prevailed. And this group was detailed into Iraq. Again, over the protests of the professionals, you don't take a secret group that's been operating in the cold without any disclosure and bring them into a military situation. It just doesn't work. You're cheapening the process, as people told me. So certainly Rumsfeld and higher-ups in the White House had to approve this decision. It was a very sensitive decision to take this secret unit and move them somewhere. And I guess I'm saying if the CIA managed to figure out what's going on and write reports about it and pull its people out, I think there's a tremendous sense that we don't have the whole story. It clearly is much more known inside Washington, much more known about the general commands, the Lieutenant General Sanchez, Ricardo Sanchez. I think we don't know the full extent of his knowledge about what was going on in that prison. And can you draw a line? I would never suggest that Donald Rumsfeld, or Condoleezza Rice, or Richard Cheney, Dick Cheney, or the president knew what was going on in Abu Ghraib and looked the other way. Of course not. Nobody in his right mind would countenance it. But I think it's impossible not to draw the line between an attitude a permissive attitude that began very early in the war, that ended up in Abu Ghraib, ended up in across the board, our prison system has been riddled with allegations of serious misconduct. And it's just, you know, in Vietnam, when there were abuses, when somebody shot a Vietnamese, and this officer, what I'm telling you now sounds bizarre, but believe me, this is literally correct. There was something known as MGR, the Mayor Gook Rule, Gook being the pejorative word for Vietnamese. Yeah. And if you were accused of shooting a Vietnamese civilian, your defense was MGR. It was merely a Gook, sir. And this, of course, was not written, but this was so much in the practice that I could write books and even citing it as a defense, the first primary defense. It took a very exceptional officer to still prosecute somebody. So we really had a dehumanization of the Iraqi prisoners. And we had, and to this day in Guantanamo, they had the first process the other day in which they actually decided whether somebody legitimately belonged there or not, 3 years later.
Yeah,
I mean, the notion that we're not differentiating between our prisoners from the beginning is such a violation of international law. That's clearly abuse. Well, of course, this White House, by the way, I ought to add, they have their own definition of abuse and their own definition of torture. So they can easily dismiss such allegations because they define it in much different ways.
Seymour Hersh, I want to look at the denials that have come out from really all sides here. But of course, speaking of this White House and abuse, you know, you, as your editor David Remnick at The New Yorker points out in the introduction here, have often been seen as abusive by this White House. Richard Perle, with his connections to the Defense Policy Board before, called you the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist. President Bush is quoted in Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, saying to President Musharraf, of all things, Seymour Hersh is a liar. And on Abu Ghraib in particular, Pentagon spokesman Lawrence DeRita saying that you threw a lot of crap against the wall and he expects someone else to peel off what's real. It's a tapestry of nonsense. Just in the last few days, Donald Rumsfeld has said, yes, he approved use of harsh interrogation measures, but only for a defined period and only at Guantanamo. Condoleezza Rice saying of that 2002 meeting in the White House, yes, they talked about overcrowding. No, she gave no sign off to abuse. And of course, the Pentagon putting out, even before your book hit the shelves, sort of a page long statement. Slamming it for being based on unnamed sources and saying they'd be happy to entertain any of these allegations if the people who are making them would just come forward and participate in the investigation process. Everybody's denying here, Seymour Hersh.
Well, I'm fascinated by the comment that was made when I first wrote about Abu Ghraib in May when Larry DeRita, who's the Pentagon spokesman, I don't know the guy, made that statement about throwing mud against the wall and seeing what will be peeled off. We've now had, what, 8 investigations that have been made public so far? I think by any definition, what I wrote was probably quite minuscule compared to what really we've learned. The scandal was spread. Initially, the Pentagon said, of course, it was only the seven bad apples, and now we know it went much beyond. There are military intelligence officers who have been charged.
And yet we've got Jackson Deal writing in the Washington Post just yesterday saying that cynics will not be surprised to learn that senior military commanders and Bush administration officials are on the verge of avoiding any accountability for the scandal of prisoner abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite the enormous damage done by that affair to U.S. standing in Iraq and around the world.
There's a military intelligence sergeant I know named Sam Provance who came forward and told investigators some of the things he saw, and he added a great deal of information to what was made known. And he told the press something in May after my stories, and he went on and told various investigators much more. That there was a general named Fay who did an investigation, and he has now been charged with a court-martial allegation because he did not come forward in immediately and make it known what he knew. In other words, the mere fact that he's gone public has subjected him to being accused of a court-martial offense of not making known at in real time when he learned, you know, he was there in the prison all in the fall of 2003. Mm-hmm. Under that standard, I would suggest that a major percentage of the people in the prison operation in Baghdad and Iraq in 2003 and the commanding officers would be in real trouble.
If they stood up and say, Seymour Hersh, stand by for a moment. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. They've been waiting patiently. Ronnie is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Ronnie. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I agree with the with your guest, and that this all seems too coordinated to be just a few rogue, you know, bad apples. Anywhere from, you know, other scandals, other abuses coming up from other prisons around Iraq, and medical examiners having to stay silent about the abuses that they witness, and even Doctors Without Borders withdrawing their doctors from other prisons. It just seems to me that all of this seems too coordinated to be just a low-lying level that I definitely agree it goes much higher in the system.
But, Ronnie, why couldn't it be a gang of soldiers that just kind of got off on a tear, lost their bearings, and went too far?
I don't understand how somebody could go that far and lose all sense of morality, especially doctors, where they notice this, where they notice prisoners being abused, being injured, and they ignore their personal duty to heal people.
It makes it look like part of a systemic effort. To you, Ronnie, thanks for your call. Seymour Hersh, you report in your epilogue here that in May 2004, you say, if I've got this right, Dick Cheney called Donald Rumsfeld and said, essentially, don't worry, no resignations are going to be required here. We want to hunker down and tough this out, as bad as it looked then.
Stay the course. It's interesting what Dick Cheney didn't say. He didn't say, oh, my God, what's going on there, Rumsfeld? Let's get this cleaned up. What's going on? I want a full report tomorrow. And just to echo what your caller said, we know that the abuses began, according to all the public of the various investigations, in late September, perhaps early October. And they only ended when one of the people in the unit in December, in January, came forward with what? With photographs, a CD-ROM with photos. So if it's a few people on their own, they were able to operate for 4 months with enormous intensity in violating, you know, dogs, the whole picture. It is so completely illogical. And I will tell you that this latest investigation by James Schlesinger is a pretty – I always like Jim Schlesinger. He's a good guy. He's really angered a lot of the officers.
The former defense secretary. Why?
Yeah, well, because they thought this was the most, because he absolutely ruled out any possibility that any higher-ups could know. And
so he left it all sort of at colonel level and below.
Yes, and the problem with that, of course, is that the generals are really angry because the – look – what do we do when we give our kids to the military? I'm a parent. Our sons and daughters go, and what's the obligation of the military? They're in loco parentis. They're the parents, and it's not only to keep the kids. You can imagine how frustrating it must be for the soldiers in the field to see their children, their wards get blown up, but it's also to keep them from doing things that would be crazy and detrimental to themselves and others. And everybody failed those people in Abu Ghraib.
Everybody
failed them.
Seymour Hersh, stand by. Seymour Hersh's new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. You can join our conversation tonight. Is Seymour Hersh a hero to you or a provocateur? What about those unnamed sources? Does their use bother you, or is that what it takes to get the truth told today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His new book is Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib, and it is turning head. The Pentagon denying pretty much categorically, even before they read the book, it appears, Hersh's report. What do you make of all this? Do you buy the picture of duplicity and manipulation in the Bush administration that Seymour Hersh presents? And 35 years after My Lai, how is it that so much top-tier muckraking still depends on one man, Cy Hersh? And then there's this. Can you reconcile the two realities offered here by Seymour Hersh and by the White House? What's going on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi there. You know, I find it interesting that no one really commented in all of this about the history of what might be perceived as the worst event in history, and that would be the Holocaust to me. And you know what? And what ordinary people will do in extraordinary circumstances. And it seems to me that a lot of blame has to be placed on the administration for demonizing those, for demonizing, in a sense, the Iraqis, to the extent that ordinary people will do extraordinary, not positive things.
But, Daniel, let me ask you, Saddam Hussein was certainly demonized. The famous deck of cards, top officials were demonized, but the entire Iraqi people?
Well, I think that's the coin of this culture. You know, the fact that that you have this event happening, you know, people, it's kind of like, the Hitler's Lonely Executioners, the Goldhagen story, which would argue that...
About German soldiers and what they were brought to.
Right, and they were brought there because their leadership led them there. This became the coin of this exchange. You know, you make the enemy a demon. You can't be surprised when your troops, therefore, treat them as enemy spawn. I mean,
Daniel, let us pick it up, and thank you for your call. Seymour Hersh, how about it? You've seen the United States at war from Vietnam to where we stand right now. There's always a cultural element to it. Is that an excuse at some level? Does it make this inevitable at some level? Can you pin responsibility for that on anybody?
Well, unfortunately, there is a racist element to this. And I used to joke that, it was sort of a sad black joke, that President Clinton always won my admiration because he was the first president since World War II to bomb white people. When we bombed Yugoslavia. Mm. Before that, we had always managed to go to war with the Third World and people of color. And so I think certainly in Vietnam there was a sense, I talked about the word gook, and I think there is a sense that it's inevitable with an enemy, and you have to really, it takes enormous leadership to understand that everybody isn't a Saddam, and that many of the people in the country are innocent victims. I think one of the tragedies of the war right now is the extraordinary number of civilian casualties that get very little attention. I mean, they're just a number. I don't fault the reporters for it because it's very hard right now and very dangerous to get out. But the chaos inside the average family, and I know some people in Iraq, average families, and it's overwhelming. These are people that have been in Baghdad in some areas, many areas, forget electricity, no mail, no phone, no sanitation, no running water since March of last year.
And you're saying it doesn't get enough attention. But you wrote this in the book, Chain of Command. You quote a Pentagon advisor saying that the torture came down to, he said, it's about rage and the need to strike back. It's evil, but it's also stupid. But that seems a little bit different from a whole culture of callousness or racism. There was a blow to the United States. There was this felt need to strike back.
This is early in the war.
Yeah.
This is somebody explaining why they set up that special unit.
Yeah.
And Rumsfeld's a man of enormous action. He likes to move. He's very competitive. He was competitive all the way with the CIA in terms of collecting intelligence. We know that from all the scandals we've had about... about the INC and all the various problems we've had in terms of the Pentagon stovepiping, as you mentioned, intelligence. Mm. And so Rumsfeld was, a few months into the war, we were getting a lot of support in after 9/11 from a lot of third-party worlds that never, you know, countries that never dealt with us, Yemen, Sudan, were saying, we think we have somebody here who might be useful to you. And in order to go through the process of extraditing him, legally, it took time. You had to go to the American ambassador. You had to go to legal processes. That went, Rumsfeld said, the hell with it. Let's get these people and get them quick. And that's why he set up the unit.
Of course,
that was the rage. That was the rage he was talking about, the immediate response.
I can imagine a lot of Americans at the time in the vulnerability and fear that you described appreciating that. Tom's calling from Turtle Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'm just calling. You had talked about interviewing the prisoners in Guantanamo and talking to them, whoever interviewed them, and they admitted that they weren't part of Al-Qaeda. But if they were, do you think they'd admit being part of Al-Qaeda?
Tom, are you suggesting, Tom, that torture was necessary or justified?
No, I'm just saying the interviewer that was there to talk to them, I mean, he's going on what they're telling him. And that's what he's basing his facts on, is they're not part of it.
Never an easy business interrogating. Cy Hersh?
Well, a perfectly fair comment, but the only thing I can tell you, I wish I could tell you more about the person who did the interviewing. He was born in Palestine. He was an older man. He was working for the CIA as an analyst. He was their Islamic expert. He went and he talked to the prisoners extensive periods, and he concluded, and we're not talking about an amateur. We're not talking about some street cop. This is a very sophisticated man in that part of the world. And he concluded in his report, the one that was eventually ended up at Condoleezza's desk. I don't know if Condoleezza Rice read it. I mean, you know, people in the government are very busy. They read executive summaries summaries. But and it was his firm conclusion that of the 30 people he spent time with, half of them there was no connection between acts of terror and their arrest. They simply, in one case, one of the cases, somebody talked. So I understand this comes from people he discussed this with. One of the guys, his father had a longstanding problem with one of the warlords that was friendly to us, and a warlord told the American troops that this guy is a Taliban, and the father and five or six or a whole bunch of his sons were taken away. And I hear what you're saying, but I think you also have to understand that in our urgency and in our need to grab people, I don't think there's any question that many people have been detained that had no reason to be. And in fact, in the Dacuba report, the famous report done by the Major General Antonio Dacuba, the one report that I got my hands on, the secret report, the first really in-depth study.
The one that said sadistic, blatant, wanton criminal abuse at
right.
Abu Ghraib.
Right. Yeah. Dacuba suggested that, I think if I remember correctly, as many as 70% of those people in Abu Ghraib did not belong there. And Amnesty International, at least maybe perhaps it was Human Rights Watch, one of the human rights groups, had even had a higher number, as many as 90%. Clearly, there's a huge problem that existed then of people not being differentiated as required under the Geneva Convention.
So, let me get another call here, Seymour Hersh. Sean is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I'm calling to commend Mr. Hersh on his work. I really appreciate what he's doing, and anyone out there who would tell him that he wasn't being a patriotic and was a muckraker would be mistaken. My father was a combat veteran in the 196th Light Infantry Brigade in Vietnam from 67 to 69. He suffered severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think by his unveiling what happened at My Lai showed a lot of what happened all over the place when war occurs. And I think that by bringing stuff like this to light, it could actually end the war prematurely and save lives.
Seymour Hersh, do you want to respond to that? There's a personal thanks to you.
Well, I'm really grateful for that, and I do hear that a lot. And I also hear, as you mentioned, I hear other people saying other things about me, too. Let me say this in general. I've been a reporter for, 40 years, and I grew up, my parents were immigrants. I grew up in a lower middle class family. I paid nothing for education. I was the government, the United States of America, you know, the system took care of me. I graduated from college. I was not editor of the Yale Daily News or the Harvard Crimson. And 11 years after graduating from college in Illinois, in Chicago, I'm sticking two fingers in the eye of a sitting American president, Richard Nixon, with the My Lai stories.
Yeah.
And I get Pulitzer Prizes and fame and glory. America. And there's nobody that can tell me that this isn't the most amazing place to live in and the most democratic. And I absolutely believe that I have as much right and am as much an American to do what I do as a four-star general or the Secretary of Defense or the National Security Advisor. That's the way it is. And that's just a very important thing. You have to understand that being critical of your country doesn't mean you don't love your country.
I've got one more question, but first, Sean, thank you for that call and that personal story. Seymour Hersh, we've got half a minute left. How high do you think responsibility for what happened at Abu Ghraib, with all of its terrible price to America's standing in the world, how high will it go? Have we seen it? Are we done?
I don't think there's any question that we're talking now about. We're not saying that anybody in the White House authorized what happened, but the idea that there was much mistreatment of prisoners consistently from the very beginning goes to the very top. Knowledge of that certainly went into the White House, certainly went to Condoleezza Rice, certainly went to Donald Rumsfeld. And as I say, Dick Cheney, he doesn't tell Rumsfeld, investigate this. He says, cover it up. You can draw your own conclusions.
Seymour Hersh, the new book is Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker magazine. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, President Bush addresses the National Guard Association as questions swirl about his own Guard service. This is On Point. President Bush barely made a mention of the controversy surrounding his Vietnam-era military service during an address before the National Guard Association in Las Vegas today. 19 individuals have served both in the National Guard and as President of the United States, Bush said, and I'm proud to be one of them. From there, the president focused his comments on what he called the accomplishments of the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. On Thursday night, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry will address the same National Guard Association, and we will bring you an excerpt of his speech. Tonight, we bring you President Bush speaking to the Guard in Las Vegas.
Liberty is powerful. Liberty can change nations. Someday, an American president will be sitting down with the duly elected leader of Iraq, talking about the peace, and our children and grandchildren will be better off for it. I believe that millions in the Middle East plead in silence for their liberty. I believe that if given the chance, they will embrace the most honorable form of government ever devised by man. I believe this because freedom is not America's gift to the world. Freedom is the Almighty God's gift to each man and woman in this world. For all Americans, these years in our history will always stand apart. There are quiet times in the life of a nation when little is expected of its leaders. This isn't one of those times. This is a time when we need firm resolve, clear vision, and deep faith in the values that make us a great nation. None of us will ever forget that week when one year ended and another began. 3 years ago today, September the 14th, 2001, I stood in the ruins of the Twin Towers. It's a day I'll never forget. There were workers in hard hats there yelling at me at the top of their lungs, whatever it takes. I was trying to do my best to console and thank the rescuers. A guy grabs me by the arm, he looks me straight in the eye, and he says, "Do not let me down." I wake up every morning thinking about how to better protect America. I will never relent in defending our country, whatever it takes. And I know that is your commitment as well. You've shown it by your commitment to service, your standards of honor, and your performance of duty. American citizen soldiers reflect great credit on our military and on our country. And I'm here to thank you for your service. May God bless you, and may God continue to bless the United States of America.
President Bush speaking before the National Guard Association in Las Vegas today. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry will address the same audience on Thursday. We will bring you an excerpt of his speech as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.